Dear child, what a pity it is I am not dead for your sake. The Lindens would then have a worthy representative and enjoy all the benefits of the illustrious blood of the Barrys of Barryville. Would they not?
Our three gents are on a quest to become gentlemen on episode number 45 of the Cut Print Film Podcast. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave and Chris.
Greetings everyone out there in the podcast world. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast. I am one of your hosts and my name is Chris Evangelista.
I'm Lord Jeffreyton of House Rollins.
I'm Lyndon David.
That one doesn't really work as well.
I'm the Lindbergh baby.
And now that all the energy has been sucked from the room, welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast. We are a podcast all about movies.
That's right. We talk about current movies, old movies, movies that haven't been made yet.
Yeah. Snuff
and the
movies.
The awards they give to movies, too.
Yes. And you can see
documentaries, science fiction.
We're going to list all the genres?
Yeah, every genre. Let's go.
That now, seems very self-indulgent.
From beginning to end. That's what we do for the whole show. And you can check everything we write at cutprintfilm.com. It's our website.
Or in the sky. I write with my plane sometimes. So.
That seems like a waste of energy and fuel. Yeah, you can also check us out on Twitter at cutprintfilm. And please, for the love of all that is sacred, please give us a good review on iTunes.
Right. If you don't, they beat us.
Yeah, they flog us with a cat o' nine tails.
It's really uncomfortable.
We depend on these reviews because they get the word out. They get our podcast listed on the new and noteworthy on iTunes. And, you know, more people listen. So give us that nice review.
Please. Won't you?
And specifically click on my reviews and my articles because, you know, we need the clicks there.
Well, I feel that they're all equal, really. We have a fine team of writers.
Hey.
What have you guys been up to this week? Anything good happen?
Well, earlier in the week, I announced the Oscar nominations. And by announced, I mean I copied and pasted them onto cutprintfilm.com.
We should have just guessed them a few minutes before they actually announced.
Yes, and never updated the correct ones.
The Oscars were announced.
Right.
The nominations were announced, and
congratulations are in order. Good job, Jeff.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Best supporting podcaster.
Best torso, I believe. I guess. there's been quite an uproar over the list of nominees for Best Picture, specifically.
Just in general, I would say this is one of the most shocking years of nominations I can remember in a long time. It's bizarre what got. But got snubbed, as they say.
Yeah, notably Nightcrawler.
Right.
Jake Gyllenhaal's performance in Nightcrawler. Nobody apparently saw the film.
Yeah.
They got no award nods.
That seemed like a given. It seemed like everyone just assumed, oh, Jake Gyllenhaal, he's going to get a nomination because that performance was career-defining. It made everyone see him in a new light.
I thought he was going to win.
Yeah. Not even nominated. Nope. Nothing.
Yeah.
So that's one of the bigger shocking ones. What else? What else shocked people?
Well, let's stay in the best actor category. Steve Carell is nominated for his role in Foxcatcher.
Which, no.
For best leading actor. And I didn't really know that he was the lead in that film. I thought that was Channing Tatum.
Yeah, that upsets me because his nomination, it's like it bumps out people who could be in there.
Like David Oyelowo from Selma. Who absolutely should have been nominated.
That's another one that just seems like a given. It just seems like, oh, he's going to get nominated. But no.
But who? Another crazy Best Actor nomination is Benedict Cumberbatch for The Imitation Game. Did either of you see that movie?
I haven't seen it yet, but I expected him to get nominated just because of the buzz. But you don't think he should have been nominated for that?
No.
Okay.
And not that I dislike Benedict Cumberbatch, but he is playing Sherlock. Who's playing Khan? Who's playing Alan Turing?
No.
It's nothing special that you haven't seen before from this actor.
Did you guys realize that Iñárritu is the only not white person nominated for something in the major category?
He's technically not white. I mean, he's Spanish.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't really.
But that's like
he's not Caucasian.
I got to stretch it that far for there to be one non-white person nominated in every major category.
I mean, yeah, that was the biggest complaint. on the Twitterverse and onward was that it's a very white year for some reason. There's not, especially for the acting categories, there's no, mm-hmm. it's all white people. There's not a single person of color nominated for acting, which is kind of bizarre and weird, especially this year when there were, in 2014 rather, where there were many performances you could have nominated.
Well, Robert Duvall has leather skin, so
that's true. He does. He's part reptilian.
Yeah. Can I just say how furious I am that the judge can now claim it's a film that has an Oscar nomination to its name
for Best Supporting Actor?
Yeah. Because no, yeah. And no offense to Robert Duvall, who is a great actor, but
phenomenal actor. But come on.
But he's playing he's playing a character in this film he's been playing for the last 10 years of the cranky old man. That's all he plays anymore because that's all he can play.
This seemed like the exact same character as his. Portrayal in Get Low.
Yeah, that's all it is.
He's a curmudgeon.
He's a cranky old man, but he has sort of a nice heart. That's the character. And you know what? Fuck the judge. That is a shitty movie. It does not deserve any recognition.
What about Best Supporting Actress? You got Patricia Arquette for Boyhood, Laura Dern for Wild, Keira Knightley again for Imitation Game,
right.
Emma Stone for Birdman, and Meryl Streep for Into the Woods, which I'm just stunned to see this film cropping up.
Yeah, I would say the only one of those I'm not happy with, and I haven't even seen Wild, but I love Laura Dern, so I'm fine with that, but the only one I'm not happy with is Meryl Streep, because enough.
You saw Into the Woods.
I did, and it's not a terrible movie, but she's one of the worst parts of the film. Her and Johnny Depp give the weaker performances.
Yeah. I feel like Laura Dern's not really in Wild enough for that to even be considered like a supporting role.
I feel like her nomination, and the Oscars do this all the time, it's like a pity nomination. It's, we're recognizing you've done years of good work that we've never recognized. It's like when they gave Scorsese Best Director for
The Departed.
Which I liked The Departed, but come on, that was not one of his best films.
Yeah, but it's no Raging Bull, for sure.
Supporting actress is a weird category, because I can't think of stuff that should be in there.
I mean,
that's not in there. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a problem in and of itself, which means there's not enough good roles for females, especially to be supporting.
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Maybe Anne Hathaway for Interstellar.
Maybe, I mean, but
Jessica Chastain.
Jessica Chastain should have been nominated for Best Actress. I would say most wanted year or supporting.
I would take either for that role because she's almost not in that enough for it to be. I guess she's the lead actress.
She's the lead actress in that film. I mean,
she's the only woman in the movie.
I'm happy Emma Stone got nominated because I really liked her in Birdman.
She was great. She was great in Birdman.
I mean, I think it's sort of like a given at this point that Patricia Arquette's going to win that award.
I do too. I'd be absolutely stunned if anyone but Patty Arquette wins.
That's the other thing. Like, I feel like this is the most boring list of nominations possible because you know who's going to win. Because do we want to jump into Best Picture already, or do we want to talk about some other nominees?
I just wanted to say, I wouldn't be too upset with these nominations if I could go through and pick the winners, but it's the ancillary films that are in there that shouldn't be in there that make this scary.
And like, I mean, it's not even that these are bad movies. I think the majority of these nominees, they're for really good movies, but it's sort of just predictable at this point.
Like American Sniper?
Ugh. All right, Dave, you watched American Sniper. American Sniper had a huge weekend this weekend. It's the biggest January weekend of a film ever.
Yeah, and I believe it open up bigger than Guardians of the Galaxy?
It did.
Okay,
that's
incredible.
Film. And it's also been playing for a few weeks in other cities, but it had a huge weekend. It was up against Black Hat, which bombed terribly. Black Hat had the worst opening for the number of screens in film history. It took in like $4 million, which is embarrassing.
Do you know how many screens?
4 million.
It was over two.
That's a lot of screens.
No, it was over 2,000 screens.
Over 2,000 screens, and it made $4 million.
Yeah,
boy, that's bad.
And I have no problem with that because as much as I love Michael Mann, Black Hat is terrible. And you can read my review of it on cutprintfilm.com.
It's scathing.
It's a bad movie. But Dave, American Sniper, how is that film?
It is not good.
Okay.
The first 20 minutes are promising, and you're like, wow, okay, this could be good. And then it just starts falling apart. Mm. It gets too, like, it turns into like an 80s action movie.
Right.
And the denouement is like this sniper versus sniper thing from the top of a building. Right.
It's a regular enemy at the gates.
Ugh.
And there's a sandstorm coming.
Oh, get it.
And
stop.
There's actually a scene where
was the mummy controlling the sandstorm?
It's the Scorpion King.
And he should the building surrounded by enemies who don't know that they're on the top of the building, but he has the shot and he can't resist taking it.
All right, so my guess is all of this did not actually
happen. No, none of this happened. Okay. So he takes the shot and he gives away their position. So then all the guys start it's like 100 million guys come out of nowhere.
It sounds like it's a scene from the film The Raid. It doesn't sound like it's real.
It reminded me of like foot soldiers from the Ninja Turtles movies coming through a hallway and like getting
the Foot Clan is coming to get.
And as we all know, they were robots. Were these robots, Dave?
Yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, there's a.
You didn't see that coming, did you?
I didn't.
There's a lot of controversy about American Sniper. For one thing, majority of reviews have not been positive toward the film. They say it's just a weak movie. They say Bradley Cooper is very good, but the movie itself...
It's shit. It's poorly directed.
And as I think everyone knows at this point, even people who haven't seen the movie, there's a really fake baby in the film,
yeah.
Which is actually in the trailer, which is insane that they would put the baby
there's
in
There's so much more of it in the movie.
Really? There's a lot more fake baby?
Like, listen, too much fake baby.
I'm going to pay money to go see this film because I want to catch up with my Oscar nominations, and I can't wait to see this bad boy on the big screen with that fake baby.
It's an IMAX. They released this... IMAX, which I think contributed to why it made so much money.
Yeah, probably.
Not only is there a fake baby, but there's...
Oh, good.
But, that's the noise over top.
The big controversy about American Sniper is Chris Kyle himself. He's portrayed in a very positive light in the film, would you say, Dave?
Yeah, extremely positive. The only negative is that, like, oh, man, maybe he feels bad, like, sometimes. That's all.
And in real life... And from his own admission in the book that he wrote, he was kind of an asshole, if I can dare say that.
Well, his estate lost a libel suit things that he said in his book, the book that this film is based off of.
Yeah,
so let that sink in that this man, his estate lost a libel suit against a madman named Jesse the Body Ventura.
Yes, Jesse
they
Ventura.
Lost, his good word is better than Chris Kyle's.
Yeah, he's considered an American hero. So just think about how much you'd have to be lying to be found
there's
guilty
this,
of that.
There's this weird problem where if you call Chris Kyle out on his bullshit, you get attacked as being like
anti-American,
which is not. It's like
it's a reasoned reaction. It's well thought out.
it's this weird mentality that certain people have that all soldiers, no matter who they are, and it applies to police too. Soldiers and police, they're all saintly, blameless people. And look, I'm not knocking the job they do because I could never fucking be a soldier. I wouldn't last like
that's why we're behind microphones.
Yeah, I wouldn't last 1 second out there, but it's silly to deify people like this. They're humans. They're you know, they make mistakes.
Yeah. They're not infallible.
And Chris Kyle, he came back and he had PTSD and that's another thing. All reviews I read, they say the film downplays that.
I don't know. I wouldn't. I don't know. I don't,
you don't
think
so.
I mean, there's a fucking scene where he's just sitting in a chair staring at the TV and it's not on, and it's a pretty creepy scene.
Okay.
So they play it up enough, I'd say.
Okay. Well, then I guess the problem. So I mean, what is your biggest problem with the film other than
it's very poorly directed. Okay. Like it looks bad, very bad. There's the action scenes are poorly lit.
I believe it was directed by America's pop, Clint Eastwood.
Yes. The man who talks to chairs,
yes.
Clint Eastwood.
So we went off on a little tangent there, but American Sniper is nominated for Best Picture, and it probably shouldn't be.
No, and you know they're allowed to nominate 10 movies for Best Picture. They only nominated 8,
right.
Which they left off some great movies.
I mean, they easily could have gotten Nightcrawler in there.
Easily.
I mean,
Under the Skin we know is ineligible.
Right, because it's unrated, which is a stupid law. I mean, stupid rule. Law. Yeah.
You broke the law, Under the Skin.
That's
my Bobby voice.
Yeah, that is excellent.
I'm thrilled Whiplash got nominated just because it's just a small movie, so I'm glad that's getting rated.
Yeah, that's like the one cool thing, besides Grand Budapest, which could have not made this list easily.
No, yeah. But, I feel like
it's so bad.
I feel
that's not what I meant.
I feel like hands down the biggest controversy everyone's talking about is the Selma snubbing in general, because Selma got two nominations, one for Best Picture, which it deserves.
The second one is the one that counts.
Yeah, the second one for Best Song, which just seems offensive because it's like, we know black people are really good at rapping, so let's give them a nomination for that.
It's incredibly insulting.
Yes.
It's so unself-aware that I had to I had to read this twice. Are you sure this is what you meant to post, Chris? No, that's right. It was nominated for Best Picture and Best Song. No actors were nominated for supporting or lead or actresses, or no directing, no technical nominations, nothing.
It's like I saw like Patton Oswalt had a tweet and it was like, that's Selma, great, great movie. The actors, the directing, not so good, but the movie, really good. Oh, and the song. And it's like, come on, like, how do you not give Best Director nomination for that? It's just,
especially with giving Mortimer Tillingdon for the Imitation Game.
Yeah, Mordecai Tillingdon, yeah. I believe his name.
Mortimer Tillingdon got a nomination for the Imitation Game, and that film is just so blandly directed.
It's poorly, like, while watching it, I was like, that shot could have been a lot better.
Yeah.
Because there's this cool concept scene of Turing's machine and how those circle things that move look like the gears on a tank.
Yeah.
And you could have seamlessly faded into the gears on a tank.
Right.
But he doesn't do it right. Like, it's at an angle and it's off. Ugh. I'm just like, who the fuck
directed this thing? It's almost like a television movie.
Yeah. It's like a BBC movie.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I feel like with Selma, I feel like that Best Picture nomination is like a pity thing. I feel like they were like, oh... I feel like at the last minute, the Academy was like, uh-oh, they're going to think we're racist. Let's give Selma a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, but we're going to think that anyway with the Best Director category, especially because it would have been the first African-American woman to ever be nominated.
And I would say that wouldn't be like – there's a certain amount of people out there, I'll call them assholes,
all right,
who think people would be like, oh, you're only going to nominate Selma because it's a black movie. Like people – people do, and like you may be hearing this right now, you may think, that's silly, Chris. No one thinks like that. But no.
Oh, they do.
There are people out there who think that.
There are people with assholes for faces that say that exact thing.
But this is so not the case with this movie. This is a legitimately great film, mm-hmm. and it deserves recognition. And the fact that they couldn't nominate it for Best Director is just like, or actor, or actress. It has a great actress performance. And it's just like, nope, nothing. It's weird. It's just, I don't understand why it would happen at this point.
Yeah.
It could have been in every category.
It could have.
I mean, and then you have like Bennett Miller nominated for Best Director for Foxcatcher, but Foxcatcher doesn't get a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah. I mean,
Foxcatcher was gorgeous, though, so I don't have an issue with that.
Yeah, I don't either.
It's weird how you, like, I never understood that correlation. How do you nominate for something for picture but not director? It seems like they should be, it's like a, like, I feel like there shouldn't even be a director category. I feel like they should just be combined. Like, the director gets... because the Best Picture Oscar doesn't go to the director, it goes to the producers.
Yeah.
But, like, I feel like...
the ones that did all the work.
Yeah. I feel like that those two categories should be lumped together, and the director and the producers get the award for picture.
I don't know, because you could have a movie that's more skillfully directed, but is...
I guess
it's not as good of a movie.
But, like, how often did they get nominated in these categories?
Are they ever – last year they were different. Gravity won.
No, it's different all the time. I always feel like it's just a weird sort of thing.
Yeah. It is strange, but then picking apart – once you lump those two together, it's like, well, you could lump together the other – like the cinematography.
I guess. But even that, no. See, like, I guess you're right. I don't know. It's a weird. It's just weird in general.
It's all arbitrary.
Well, yeah. Let me just. Just in general, I'm not a fan of Oscars in general. I feel like it's a silly.
I enjoy the pomp and circumstance.
I do. I do too. And that's all I care about. The award means nothing because Spike Lee said about Selma being, right, you know, pretty much brushed under the carpet. To the director, Ava DuVernay, you know, fuck him. You made a great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all that really matters. Go out and make another great one. And that's true. She made a great movie. This is a new director that I'm excited about seeing what she does next.
Yeah.
Also, David Oyelowo. I'm excited to see what he does next.
Yeah. And David Kostel, right?
Nope. No. Couldn't care less what David Kostel does, unless it's his funeral. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Coffin sizing is what he's up to.
The thing about the Oscars that I like is that it brings the merit of film into the forefront of media. You know what I mean?
See,
it gets it on people's minds. And
I don't like it because I hate that it turns films into like a team sport. I hate that. I don't know, it's like a double-edged sword because I like when a good film is recognized. But I also hate when a film that isn't that great wins and then idiots use that as like, here's the proof. It won an Oscar. It's like, no, stop it.
I just feel like if we didn't have the Oscars or any of the awards, that movies would just start to fall away. Like, I feel like some of these smaller movies get made with the, like, oh, this could win an Oscar. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, one thing I do like about the Best Picture, one of the only things I like about the Best Picture category this year is that a lot of these movies nominated are small movies.
Yeah.
Aside from American Sniper and maybe The Grand Budapest Hotel, these are all indie film. Birdman is an independent film.
Yeah.
I would say
Boyhood is
Grand
an independent
Budapest
film.
Is still independent. That was
it is, but I'm saying for this year, it's one of the bigger films.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it made
Whiplash. Nobody saw Whiplash. Yeah. Theory of Everything. Hardly anybody saw that.
I saw
Whiplash.
I didn't
made
like it.
$2 million. Yeah. Whiplash made like no money at the box office. Which, so
I think it's getting like a re-release though. Yeah, now, so it will. But would you guys say it's like a given at this point that Boyhood is going to win Best Picture?
Probably.
I honestly don't see any.
I say it's between Boyhood and Birdman. Yeah, I can't imagine. I want Grand Budapest to win. I want it to win so badly.
Right.
But it's going to be Boyhood or Birdman.
If I had to pick a film out of this list that I wanted to win, it would definitely be Grand Budapest. But
I could see Wes Anderson winning Best Director this
year. Yeah, I feel like they might do it like that. Like, they'll give him
director.
It's
time to give him, you know, like the same thing they did with The Departed. But in this case, this movie's brilliant. You know what I mean? This is one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies, so I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, I mean,
but Linkletter's in that same class.
I feel like it's sort of given that he's going to win too, because he's been working longer. Like Boyhood, that Oscar is going to be like it's an achievement award.
Yeah,
because we all know my thoughts on Boyhood, that it's not that great, but everyone loves that it took 12 years to make, and that's what they're going to be rewarded.
It took me 12 years to paint this fence white. Oh, right. Good work.
Yeah,
here's $1 million in cash prizes.
Yeah, I was saying, like, imagine if there was like a famous portrait artist, and he took 12 years to paint a portrait, and everyone saw it, and it was just like, oh, like the eyes are lopsided, but like people would just be like, "But he took 12 years." Like, I don't fucking care. Yeah. Can the movie be good? That's all I want.
I am of a mind with you, Chris.
Thanks, Jeff.
You got it.
Yeah. Okay. I won't Boyhood it up right now.
Look, we all know that you and Richard Linkletter are buds. Yeah.
I don't love Boyhood.
Your scissor sisters, if you will.
All right. So. You know who should get Best Director this year?
Who?
Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick's dead, Dave.
Yeah, and
he died years
ago. For Barry Lyndon.
So let's take a break. It's because it's been a half hour. We're going to take a break.
Yeah, let's do our break now, and then we're going to get into Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon.
For the director series.
Yes.
Let's break each other's legs, and then we'll come back.
All right.
Yeah, I have no problem with that, if it's your legs. Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
CutPrint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
Barry Lyndon. Love that cowbell in the background.
Girl, I don't know why we're dueling over all this money.
Hi everyone, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that great break.
Yeah.
Hope you bought a lot of stuff.
Yes. All our ads from Grandin Road.
Oh boy. So
wait, did you hear something?
Oh, it's still playing.
Oh, Barry White is still in the studio. His ghost.
Get out of here, Barry. We got a show to do.
See you later, Barry. Take the entire orchestra with you. And he did.
So, yeah, we're off.
Very slowly.
We are finishing our director series on Stanley Kubrick.
Tucci. Oh.
No.
Yes, the Stanley Tucci director series.
Yeah, we're wrapping things up here with 1975's Barry Lyndon.
And I think we have Jeff, do you have a piece of production for the director series?
I certainly do.
It's the CutPrint Film Director Series.
Action!
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
That's right, we have a new song for you.
Yes, I hope everyone enjoyed that. So,
as much as we enjoyed recording.
Oh, yes. We sure did have fun. Took hours. So yeah, Barry Lyndon came out in 1975. It stars Ryan O'Neal as the titular Redmond Barry,
yes.
Or who becomes Barry Lyndon later on in the film.
Yeah,
Marissa Berenson, Patrick McGee, and Leon Vitale. I got a quick synopsis here, or not so quick, depending on your...
You're just going to read the Thackeray novel?
Yeah.
From beginning to end.
It was the best of time. Oh, I have a different book in front of me. So based on the Victorian novel by William Makepeace Thackeray, which is maybe the best name in literature.
Yeah. I made peace with Thackeray a long time ago.
Well, you have to. He's a madman. Barry Lyndon tells the complex and subtle story of a sensitive, intelligent, and ambitious man trapped in a society which has no use for him. Despite the obstacle of his Irish birth and relative poverty, Redmond Barry, played by Ryan O'Neal, manages by various stratagems and devices to become the wealthy but ill-respected Barry Lyndon. Fooled into leaving his home by the family of the girl he had hoped to marry, who happens to be his cousin.
Ew.
Yes. Icky Kaka. Barry becomes a soldier during the Seven Years' War. His adventures teach him how to manipulate people, paving the way for his success. His crowning achievement as a social climber is his marriage to Lady Lyndon, played by Marissa Berenson, the beautiful and wealthy widow of an English ambassador to the courts of Europe. His stepson, whom he despises, becomes his nemesis.
We all despise this character.
Oh boy, do we ever. The deliberate pace given to this film by director Stanley Kubrick evokes the sensibility of the times and gives added force to the retelling of the novel. And the film's lavish cinematography was highly acclaimed, and it won Oscars for art direction, costume design, and musical score, adapted by Leonard Rosenman from classical sources like Bach and Handel. And that's the synopsis for Barry Lyndon.
Yes. Which I have a... I would say at the beginning...
Are you piggybacking? Would you like to piggyback on that?
Well, after the show.
Oh, okay.
But at the beginning, you mentioned that it says Barry Lyndon is a sensitive character, which I don't agree with at all. I believe he is a borderline sociopath.
Oh, here's the thing. I think Barry Lyndon starts off sensitive. I think he starts off as a relatively decent kind of guy who's looking for love, and he thinks he's found true love with his cousin, but she's just playing this manipulative game with him. And she really intends on marrying or being courted by this English captain, John Quint.
Yeah, but even that, he's being a dick about, because the whole reason she's courting fancy dancing John Quint is because the family is in terrible debt, and John Quint says, "I'll pay off that debt."
Yeah.
And Barry Lyndon knows this, and he's like, I don't fucking care. I want to have sex with my
cousin. He's got that fighting Irish thing in him.
Yeah.
I think it's a satire on that at times, that he just never stops going at. Yeah. Like, he'll never back down from anything.
Yeah, he's headstrong, which the Irish are known to do. In case you didn't know, they blow up churches in Ireland.
They're always drunk.
But, yeah, so this film starts off, it's divided into two parts.
Or acts, if you will.
Yeah, two acts.
The Phantom Menace.
No.
Attack of the Clones. And the Lyndon Strikes Back is the third one.
Wait. All of this is inaccurate. it opens with Barry Lyndon's, or Redmond Barry's father, being killed in a duel over the sale of horses.
I think, yeah. There's a lot of dueling sort of bookends every act in the film.
Yeah.
There's a duel, then there's a duel, and it ends on a duel, too.
Yeah.
Then they watch Spielberg's duel about
exactly.
The truck chasing the guy.
One of his finest films. it opens with this duel filmed from far, far away,
right.
Which I thought was a neat trick because it's so far in the past. That, and at least that's what I'm getting from it. It's filmed so far away because it's in the past and it's kind of immaterial to Barry Lyndon's story because he's pretty much a mama's boy. But the Irish countryside is absolutely breathtaking.
This whole movie is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
Holy, like there are scenes in this film that just took my breath away. And part of me, and I don't do this anymore because I'm jaded, but there were scenes where I was just like, how do they film this? Is it a matte painting or is this just all real landscape? Because if it is, it's fucking wonderful.
It's incredible.
Well, you were saying before we started that a lot of the shots look like paintings. Like the actual shot looks like a...
Kubrick clearly wanted to have almost every setup for a scene. When you come into a scene, everyone is perfectly still and they're posed.
Oh yeah, that's deliberate. He took paintings right. and staged. He built his scenes from these paintings that he found in books and in museums.
There's always like you'll have the main characters who are, they'll be the ones moving, but everyone's standing around them perfectly still. Yeah.
And they'll be like spaced out like yeah. as if it was a large canvas.
Yeah, he's, everybody's blocked as though they're. Yeah. Yeah. Coming right out of a portrait.
And I'm sure it was incredible. A nightmare to film for the actors. But yeah, I don't want to derail things. But back to your
brief. Yeah, I was just saying the look of the film, all the landscape and the scenery. It's yeah. absolutely gorgeous. It looked like I was in Ireland again. Like right. it just looks so real. And this is not even a Criterion release. This right. this was just a standard Blu-ray I watched.
I mean, that's it. Like this entire film feels authentic.
Yeah,
like it doesn't feel like a
all the costuming yeah. is period perfect.
The music is period appropriate. Like Kubrick went to great lengths. I was reading an interview with one of the producers of the film, and he was saying like he wanted it to feel just as he didn't want it to feel like clearly it's a modern movie. He wanted it to feel like, and it also explains like the pace too.
Yeah.
Just,
see, okay, I wanted to talk about the pace.
All right.
This is nearly a 2 hour or 3 hour movie.
Yes.
Nearly 3 hours. I've read over and over that people say that this is so slowly, or they politely call it deliberately paced. I thought the pacing was fantastic. I thought this movie moved along quickly and briskly. Like it's a series of scenes and events that happen to Barry, but I think everything is so interesting that it keeps my attention, and I never thought, like, I was never looking at my stopwatch that I had running from when I hit play.
Well, I thought overall, I don't think that, I feel like there are certain parts where it started to drag me down just a little bit. That could just be me.
It like has that, because it's based on the Thackeray novels, it has that structure of, I mean, it was one of the first novels ever written, so it has that early structure because they were released like almost serial.
Yeah.
That the plot has to keep building and then resolving itself
right.
over and over again. So you're never like, nothing's ever dragging on too long.
Yeah, it's like a series of vignettes.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, with the pacing, what I liked was there's narration in this. Kubrick was doing a lot of narration at this point. You know, Clockwork Orange had narration, and Killing had narration.
I love the narration.
I did too, and I think one of the things that helped with the pacing of this long, long movie for me was the narrator tells you what's going to happen in this next scene. But he doesn't tell you how. Like, he tells yeah. you what the resolution's going to be, but you're watching, how do we get to there?
It's like a tease.
It is.
It's cheeky.
It is. Yes, he's a rosy-cheeked bastard.
It is. It's like, I'm joking, but it is sort of like, it's mean in a way. Because it's,
yeah.
like, I look at the narrator in this film as like an asshole.
He's sinister, is yeah, he not?
He's like, he's omnipresent.
He's above Barry Lyndon it's like in stature,
It's
I think.
Pretty much like if it's yeah. God telling the story and God's an asshole.
Yeah, and there's this tone about his voice that is so condescending. Yeah. Like, Barry thought this was going to happen, yeah, right. but the worst thing happened.
Yeah, I love that. I love that just like, the narrator sounds sinister. It's just like.
And I think, like I said, I think that aided in my not caring about the length of this movie and the pace of it.
Yeah.
It worked for me. It kept it moving along steadily.
What I was going to say, tying into the pace, is this is probably the most uncommercial film I have ever seen in my life. Like, you would never be able to get this film greenlit today. Mm-mm. Ever.
No.
Like, I'm shocked this film exists, because there's nothing. This is the most, I'm going to say, it's the most inconsequential film I've ever seen, too. And it's great. It's a great movie, but I'm not going to say there's nothing to it, because there's a lot to it, but it's not, you know, there's no pressing matter. There's no urgency. It's just, it's a story. It's like a novel.
Yeah.
And yeah.
No one makes movies like that, and for good reason, and few people could pull it off.
My favorite novels are always literary fiction, right. so I kind of knew I was going to love this film when I read that it was based on, like, you know, the one of the first. In fact,
like the Animorphs books, right?
Exactly yeah. like that. and the fact that Barry Lyndon is literature's first anti-hero,
yeah.
that fascinated me. So I knew I was going to like this movie. I didn't know I was going to like it as much as I did. I like the slow panning out that Kubrick does,
yes.
that he also started doing in Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. that like reverse Wes Anderson zoom.
Yep. And that's where Wes Anderson got that. Yeah. He got it from
and he
Barry
even does some
he got it from Barry Lyndon.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And tying into the whole the anti-hero thing and how this is literature's first
I'm Batman.
Yes, that's what I was going for.
Batman's here, ladies and gentlemen.
So when I sat down to watch the film, I said, like, man, I wish Ryan O'Neal was not the star of this film, because when I think of actors, Ryan O'Neal does not spring to mind. But as the film drew to an end, I appreciated why Kubrick cast him, because he's really good at playing a character you don't really care about, because you don't really care about. I think that's sort of like the way, because even at the time when Kubrick cast Ryan O'Neal, everyone was like, really? Like, that doesn't seem like a Kubrick actor.
Yeah.
And I think that's deliberate, because you need to not actually root for Barry.
Did you read about why Ryan O'Neal was casted?
Because he was one of the, excuse me. He was in Love Story, and that was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And the studio would only give Kubrick money if he used a star, like a big star.
Yeah, there was a top 10 money-making star list, and it was the only people that were gender and age appropriate were Ryan O'Neal and Robert Redford.
Right. And like Robert Redford is such a better actor.
Oh yeah.
But I feel like if Kubrick had cast Robert Redford, it wouldn't work, because Robert Redford is just, he has that inherent likability, especially back then.
I think he was making The Sting at the time too.
Right.
Which
I didn't mean to cut you off. They're talking to his agent in this article right here about why Ryan O'Neal stopped acting after this, and he's saying that it's just because people didn't like him. Like, there was like a self-confident, cocky, and gorgeousness about Ryan O'Neal that just made even casting directors and people like that not want him in their movie.
And like, as the film was drawing to an end, I was like, fucking Kubrick, you magnificent bastard, I get why you cast this actor.
And this Barry Lyndon character is a blank slate. Right. He's a character. He has, like you said, Barry Lyndon's an inconsequential story.
Yeah.
And part of that is because Barry Lyndon, the character, has no consequence on anything. He's just reacting to things happening to him. He's pretty much Forrest Gump with a nefarious streak to him.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah. He's Forrest Gump with a knife in his hand.
In Roger Ebert's review of the film, he compared, I love this, because he compared Barry Lyndon, the character, to the character of Hal in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Huh.
And he says, it's because both films are about organisms striving to endure and prevail, never mind the consequence. And that's Barry Lyndon doesn't really care about who he hurts. He just wants to succeed.
In fact, I sometimes think that he is willfully trying to
absolutely.
Just destroy and betray everyone that's ever put any type of faith or trust into him.
Especially Lady Lyndon, who he's just atrocious to. There's a great scene where right after they get married, they're driving back to the mansion, and they're in a carriage, and Barry Lyndon is smoking, and his wife says, "Oh, could you not smoke?" And he fucking turns and blows smoke into her fucking face and grins.
And that is at the very end of Act One,
right?
And leading up to that, though, is Act One is the stronger act, I will say.
I'd agree. I feel like Act Two looks better. It's more visually stimulating.
Yeah, but most of it takes place indoors, whereas Act One, you get to see
battles.
There's battles. You get to see what is supposed to be the Prussian countryside, but it's really either Ireland or England.
Yeah. I liked Act Two.
I did, too.
I liked it.
You liked it more?
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know why. I just felt like it was more of a self-contained story,
You're a bit of a dandy, so you like when
dandy
people,
fop, yeah, as they say.
The second half of this film is all people in powder wigs and powdered faces.
Pastels everywhere.
Yeah, and Dave gets off on that sort of stuff, so I can see why he likes
it. Literally.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm more of like an Irish, you know, rah-rah, go Irish, everything. I think that might be why I liked Act One, because Barry Lyndon is in gun duels, he's in fist fights, he's robbed by the most polite and cordial thief ever known.
I'd say the first act of the film is the more human act.
Yeah.
He's much...
Well, he's becoming corrupted throughout Act One.
I like the asshole Barry Lyndon more.
I mean, he's an asshole in Part One, but he has that one character. Is it like his uncle? Who is that guy?
I took it as an uncle. Yeah. He's a captain in the English army.
Right. There's a running theme through the film. There's many, but there's one running theme. It's about fatherhood, because Barry Lyndon's father gets killed. He has no father figure, so he sort of adopts this guy who's really nice to him. and this guy gets killed, and it's sort of fucking, you see Barry Lyndon like break down and cry, and that's sort of like the last time in the film he shows emotion until near the end when his son dies.
Yeah.
But then after that, he has the guy with the eye patch who becomes his father figure. It's sort of like the whole movie. He's searching.
Yeah, the Chevalier.
Yeah, he's searching for a father figure until he becomes one, and he fails at that because his son dies.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I have a question because he does show emotion in one other thing, one other moment. But do you think Barry Lyndon has any real like love of England, or is he just
no?
Oh no, he doesn't give a
because
shit.
Because there's the moment.
Barry Lyndon cares about Barry Lyndon, yes. And that's it. And they even say once he rose to a status, he never wanted to go backward.
And I think that's also why the only other character in the film he shows affection to is his son, because his son is an extension of him.
Right.
So he's just loving himself pretty much.
And that goes back to the very beginning where his very first love is his cousin,
right.
Also his blood.
Well, he does cry when he meets the Chevalier. Is that how you say it?
That's true, yeah. But I feel like that's
fake.
I feel like that's crocodile tears.
Yeah.
I think that's more just like he's just exhausted because he's been through like wars.
Yeah, he's been in the Prussian army for 3 or 4 years.
Right. And they're sort of forcing him to be a spy, and he's clearly not good at it.
But this Prussian general has been so nice to him.
Right.
Even though he caught him as a deserter and forced him into the Prussian army, he has risen through the ranks and earned the trust and respect of these people. And then the second he is put in a position where he's supposed to act as a spy for this Irishman who they think might be selling secrets to the enemy, he immediately turns on him and says, I was sent here as a spy, but I'm from Ireland too.
I think that still ties into the love of Barry, because the reason he breaks is this guy's ire. He breaks the guy's, because like,
so he's loving. He's just showing more
extension of just his homeland, and like the reason he's nice to that general is it's sort of the reason when you go into prison and you cozy up to the toughest guy because you don't want to fucking get killed, and that's sort of it. Because like he tries to be rebellious and he sees like he can't do that, so he needs to get on this guy's. He sort of like sucks up to this general who keeps promoting him. But then he's just like, oh, I'm a spy.
Not 15 minutes go by, and he has confessed to being sent to spy on him.
He doesn't complete one mission. He gets...
and then they go on to play the World Series of Poker for 45 minutes, where they cheat these noblemen out of money.
Right.
Literally, they're cheating them. The Chevalier, who is the person that Barry was sent to spy on and happens to be an Irishman... is a raging gambler.
Yes.
And he loves to cheat. So he uses Barry as his, his accomplice. He tells him what the other player has, and they swindle millions of dollars. And when they don't get the money, they ask for favors from these noblemen.
I loved Patrick McGee as the Chevalier.
He was amazing.
Yeah, just the look at him. I love that tiny eye patch he had and the mole.
Yes, that drawn-on mole. It's like a perfect diamond.
I love the scene where Barry Lyndon dresses up
I
was like, what is happening?
Yeah, I was very confused, and I was like, oh, I see. I see what we're doing.
So it's the one moment of real gentlemanness that Barry Lyndon shows when he shoots his pistol into the hay that fucks him over. And that's like,
let's.
Oh, that's a good call. Like the one time he tries to be noble, he gets his leg blown off.
So let's the second he stops playing the game, it's
that is a good. Yeah, so
let's retrace and get to that point. Cause that is a great scene.
So in the second half of the film, Barry marries Lady. Did we ever find out her first name, or is it just always Lady? She signs like H, but I don't know what the hell it
is. I don't know.
Harriet Lyndon. So, he marries her. This is Lady Lyndon, played by Marissa Berenson, correct? And I loved her performance. I liked how quiet. She doesn't say a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, just acting with her eyes, and she always looks miserable.
I want to say she's not much of an actress.
Yeah, it's
and
sort of
I think
like,
that might have been why she didn't do a whole lot.
But it works.
It does. It absolutely works. It's just like the Ryan O'Neal factor.
Yeah.
He's not the world's greatest actor, but he is perfect for this part of Barry Lyndon.
So Barry marries Lady Lyndon. He takes the title Lyndon.
It's hard to get a read on her in this movie. Like, is she
into him?
Yeah.
I read it as she was very much enraptured with him, and he clearly was not with her. It was all a ruse to bring his station in life up.
He wants to rise in his stature, and they get married. Instantly she realizes, oh, this is a mistake, because he blows smoke in her face. And she has a son named Lord Bullingdon, who is a a fancy mama's boy if I've ever seen one.
This is Junior Healy in the 18th century.
It looks like him too.
Yeah. So right from even this is great casting because the actor that got to play him as a kid looks exactly like the older one.
And it does.
It like creeped me out. I was like, they look so much alike. So right away, Lord Bullingdon does not like Barry Lyndon, and it's weird because you should like Lord Bullingdon because he's correct. Barry Lyndon is an asshole.
Yeah.
But no, he's such a sniveling little twerp.
Well, and they say that he was a melancholy child, and like he clearly can read people, and he, as a child, could read, well, this man is a pile of garbage.
This is pretty much me as a kid, where I just hated everyone, and everyone hated me.
Yeah,
perfect. They saw my sourpuss. They're just like, what's his problem? So, Lord Bullingdon, he does not like Barry. Barry does not like him.
Yeah, he's constantly beating him.
Yeah, with a stick. He's whipping his ass, literally.
Yeah. And then he does whip his ass later.
Yeah, there's a scene when Lord Bullingdon, I guess he's a teenager.
Yeah.
He comes into the chamber room where is Lady Lyndon playing the harpsichord?
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Barry and Lady Lyndon, they have a son, and Barry loves this kid named Brian.
Yes.
Yeah, that's his real son.
Yeah, so he loves Brian. And Lord Bullingdon, I guess he's not jealous. He's just sort of like enough.
I think he's had it with the unfairness that he, as an actual lord.
And also it's important to point out, up until this point, Barry Lyndon has been spending like all of their money.
Oh, yes.
Because he wants a title. Because Barry Lyndon's real mother, she shows up, and she's just as conniving as he is, maybe more so.
Yeah, she's cooking the books.
Yeah, and she says, you know, you're never
going to... She pushes him to the point where she fucks things up.
Yeah, because it seems like if that hadn't happened, he would have just kept going as is. Because he's happy. He's rich now.
She's the one that got the idea of getting a title in his mind.
He's rich. He's boning the maids. He's fine as is. And she says, you know, if Lady Lyndon dies, you have nothing. So get a title.
Yeah, and to get a title, you have to buy a title. Yeah,
so he buys art, he has fancy dinners, and frowny face Bullingdon is not happy about this.
No,
God, all that spending made me so anxious. Like, whenever that's in a movie and people are wasting away their money, it fucks with me. And he did a good job of Kubrick, I mean, with those scenes with the bills where they keep going through the bills over and over again and signing checks and stuff. And it's just
signed by Delbert Grady.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You can see how much money is going away all the time.
Yeah, I like that.
Wait, Grady's back again?
Yeah. Wait. Now, was it Grady in The Killing?
Lloyd was in The Killing.
Grady.
Lloyd from The Shining was in The Killing. Grady from The Shining is in Barry Lyndon.
Yes, right before he killed his children with an axe.
Yes. Okay, so they have this... is this a fundraiser, I'm assuming?
I just think
or it's... Or is this just a concerto?
It's just a recital, because back then... This movie reminded me a lot of Amadeus, because it's the same costuming, same period. And people just did... That was...
That's all they had.
Yeah, they didn't have TV, so it's just like, oh...
Well, let's watch Lady Lyndon play the harpsichord.
Yeah, someone's going to play the harpsichord. Let's all go.
So, yeah, they have a room full of nobles, and Lord Bullingdon comes in with Barry's actual son wearing his shoes.
Oh, this scene.
So what's the little boy's name? Brian?
Brian.
He comes clomping in like a Clydesdale, and Lord Bullingdon gives this very woe is me.
Oh, this speech. He's like, oh, mother, does he not wear my shoes quite well? Just like...
Yeah, it's about as subtle as a brick to the neck. Yeah,
he's not... And this is sort of like, it's the gentlemanly way of insulting people, because you couldn't really punch people back then. So this is Lord Bullingdon's way of being like, he was, if you will, throwing shade on Barry Lyndon.
He threw thine shade, and
Barry Lyndon doesn't look too happy about it.
No, boy, is he not happy.
I will say, to his credit, he lasted a lot longer. Like, the second he did the shoe thing, I would have been up and punching Bullingdon in his ass.
Yeah. So as Chris said, you can't throw punches when you're a nobleman, a gentleman. But Barry Lyndon didn't get the message, and he punches Lord Bullingdon in the hindquarters. And then they cannot be separated.
They're rolling around in their socks on the floor.
It sounds like a basketball game.
Everyone's screaming.
There's sneakers sliding across the floor.
The Harlem Globetrotters come in on scooters.
Oh, it takes about 14 people to break these two up. And from this point forward, Barry Lyndon gets no respect from anyone
now. Because he blew it. He blew his cool. Everyone's like, oh, he's no gentleman.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't getting much respect before.
He was, though. He was rising. Remember that general?
He meets, like, the king, isn't he?
Yeah, but the king doesn't really seem impressed. He's like, you should go with them when he says he's been raising troops for the...
It feels like he was almost there. Yeah. And this
that's the impression I got. Yeah. Barry Lyndon was... just about there to get that title, and then he punched his stepson in the hiney.
Just blew right in the it. Butt. Right in the beehole.
So, yeah, Lord Boyington, from that point, just takes off. He's done. Yeah. And he tells him, you know, if you ever hit me again, I'll kill you.
Yeah. What's the arrangement there? Is Bullingdon just leaving and waiting for his mother to die at that point? Because he still has, like, an estate
I think he's doing other things. Like Lord Bullingdon, I mean, he has money. Yeah. He has his own money as the only heir to the Lyndon fortune. Yes.
Yeah, well, I think that's the problem, is that Barry's in control of most of his money
still. Right, okay, yeah. So he probably has properties that are in his name, but okay.
I think it's just that he just wants to get away. He doesn't want to be in that house anymore. So he's gone.
Bullingdon moves out. That's a whole nother movie.
Yeah.
And that I would watch, by the way.
The Bullingdon Files, where he goes around frowning at things. But yeah, so he's gone, and this is sort of like the best time of Barry Lyndon's life. He's got his son, he's got his wife, he's got his money.
Please, Papa, will you buy me a horse?
Oh, but then the narrator comes in and warns us that things were not to be as happy as they've been going.
So Barry Lyndon, even though he doesn't have the title, he's happy to have his son. But, so yeah, Barry Lyndon's son, Brian, wants a horse.
God, that scene where he gets thrown off the horse, I don't know how that was filmed.
Yeah, I don't know how they did that either.
Like, it's an actual kid being thrown off of a horse. Yeah. And
it was two people in a horse outfit.
Maybe it was four people in a little boy outfit.
And they're in a trench coat.
Yeah. It was like the Muppets gag. They're all on their shoulders.
Well, I don't know how to recover. The
kid dies a slow and painful death, essentially.
So, Barry Lyndon, he buys his son a horse. Son falls off the horse. Son dies, and it cuts to a fucking... Oh, God, that funeral shot. It was probably my favorite shot in the film. Music kicks in. Yep.
Which is more horses ruining Barry's life, because his father was killed over horses.
I didn't even make that connection.
That's like, and he gets his horse stolen by the polite robbers.
And he's a horse's ass.
Yes!
Right?
A horse is a horse, of course.
Oh, it certainly is.
And his nickname was Pony Boy, right? Oh, no,
that's a different novel.
I'm thinking of The Outsiders.
No, he was Soda Pop.
Oh, yes! He was one of the Sochas, I believe.
Soda Popinski from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out? Is that where we're going?
Yeah, let's keep going. This is good.
The inevitable next step?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Back to the real movie.
His son dies.
Yeah.
They have the funeral.
Right. Barry Lyndon is very distraught.
Oh, yes.
He drinks a lot to the point where he has to be carried.
Yes.
And then, like,
I guess alcohol back then was mixed with opium sometimes, so maybe that's what he was drinking.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And Lord Bullingdon...
Well, Delbert Grady says enough's enough, and he summons Lord Bullingdon back.
Yes. And Lord Bullingdon demands satisfaction from Barry.
In one of my other favorite shots where he goes into that, I guess it's like a den, and Barry's like asleep in that chair. Just the way that's filmed.
Yeah. That might be the best shot of the film.
So like, that looks like a painting. Like, I would like print that out.
In a film full of great shots, that's in my top five, that scene.
The other one that I really liked was Barry and Brian sitting in front of that huge painting, reading the little picture book. I don't know if you remember that one. That was fucking amazing.
I can't remember a film that has this many just gorgeous shots. It's such care.
Technically, this is one of the best films I've ever seen.
Absolutely. So
Lord Bullingdon demands satisfaction from Barry and challenges him to a duel.
And I liked how, like, when the duel comes up, Barry just – Lord Bullingdon looks fucking terrified, and Barry's just sort of like, whatever.
Yeah.
He
doesn't care at this point. His son is dead, and he is just – a piece of him has died.
Right.
Literally.
And this is the most proper duel, because the earlier duel, it's not as structured as this. This duel is like – there's a lot of rules.
Seems like the rules have changed over the years.
Yeah, I guess because, like, time has passed. Because the first duel, they shoot at the same time.
Now they both have to play banjos, which is really strange.
There's a talent portion of the duel, I believe. And then there's this
different movie, I think.
The swimsuit competition.
This duel is not in the book. Barry Lyndon.
And also to tie into the horse thing, it's in a stable, the duel.
Yes, it is, which was amazing. Yes. I thought this...
It looks like a church, kind of.
It's gorgeous. There's hay everywhere. They're in a stable. It's a stone stable, right?
Yeah, and there's pigeons. And
It's wonderful. This was not in the book. Barry Lyndon gets kicked out of the Lyndon estate and dies in jail.
Oh, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading Kubrick wanted to end it on a duel to keep the dueling theme.
It makes sense.
And the whole movie is pretty much Barry Lyndon dueling with everyone, yeah, metaphorically.
So, it's a duality.
I hate you.
Boy, I don't know about that one. So yeah, Lord Bullingdon gets to draw first, and his gun goes off in his hand.
Because he sucks.
Yes, he does. He is a nipple of a man.
Like, I almost wanted there to be like a wah, wah, wah. Like, he's looking at the gun, and it just shoots, and he's like, oh, I don't know the guy's name. He's like, Lord whatever, this gun is defective.
Yeah, well, it's almost like he brought, like, these guys whose jobs it's to conduct duels. Like, yeah, like they're
professional duel judges.
So they have the guns, and they know what's up, and he's like, oh, can I just...
Can
try
I do it
again?
And they're like, no, Lord Bullingdon.
Yeah, now it's Barry's turn. And so Barry, getting back to what Dave brought up, points his gun at the ground and fires into the ground.
It's the one noble act he ever does.
He could easily kill him legally here and be rid of all his financial problems and be in control of the Lyndon estate completely.
Yeah.
And I think this is... I don't know if maybe this is a sense of... It's either... Barry Lyndon has an innate sense of fairness, which I'm not sure I buy, or he's still trying to be a gentleman.
I just think it's defeat. Like, that's what
I don't
I
think
feel
it's
like.
Defeat.
I think it's more, it's like,
I think he's still trying to be a gentleman and a lord. He's still going for that title after everything. And he fires his gun into the ground, and they ask Lord Bullingdon, are you satisfied? And he says, no.
Yeah.
And he shoots Barry in the leg. And I think that's because Lord Bullingdon's already a lord. Right. He doesn't have to prove anything to anybody. He can do whatever he wants, including kill a man.
I kind of think it's sort of like he's trying to redeem himself.
Yeah.
I feel like
I weigh it back and forth. Is it him trying to redeem himself, or is he just the same old Barry?
Yeah, because I mean, he spent the whole movie being such an asshole. I could easily see it being that he still is trying to weasel his way out of something, but. I feel like his son dying sort of, like, humbled him. It's sort of like, he's like, oh, never mind. I don't care anymore. Maybe I should finally do something noble. And the film has such a twisted sense of humor that's like, well, the one noble thing he does gets him fucking, it ruins him forever, basically.
Yeah, and it's also like he's been beating Bullingdon his whole life, and that... Maybe in that moment he's like, let me just take it easy on this kid for once. And
then he loses
his life. Because that has caused a lot of the problems, him being mean to that kid.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I think this is just Barry trying to do something good for Barry again and not kill this
man. I could see that, too.
And maybe try and weasel something out of the fact that he let this guy live. I think that's what it is.
I like the ambiguity of it.
Yeah, there's no clear answer.
So, yeah, Lord Bullingdon says, no, I'm not satisfied. Fires his gun into Barry's leg. Barry loses the leg.
Do you think that's intentional, too? Because do you think Lord Bullingdon intentionally aimed for the leg?
No.
Or do you think it was just an accident?
I think Lord Bullingdon is a terrible, terrible shot.
Right.
And he meant to kill... I think he was aiming for the heart.
Right.
I love this scene when he shoots Barry Lyndon, because in contrast to him shooting Quinn, it's like so violent. Like,
yeah.
Barry goes flying across the room.
Yeah.
And
when John Quinn gets shot early in the film... It's all a ruse, because he's not actually shot. It's like a ruse that...
To get Barry out of Ireland.
Right. Yeah, they faked it, basically.
And at the time, I was like, man, that kind of sucked. Like,
yeah, Cooper, I did, too. I was like, what an anticlimactic duel.
And then I felt like an idiot when it was... I felt like Barry felt, which is kind of... Not exactly like he felt, but it's kind of clever in a way.
It is. So, yeah, Barry, he gets his leg shot. They have to amputate it. And so Lord Bullingdon sends Delbert Grady, and he says, here's the deal.
Always been the caretaker.
Yeah, I should know. I've always been here. So what's the deal? Does he say you can keep the money? You get a
$500, not dollar, but guinea, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's like, isn't it like an annual? He gets it like every year, basically.
For salary.
He basically buys his silence.
Yeah.
And he buys peace for his mother and himself. If Barry leaves them alone and moves back to Ireland, he'll pay him yearly 500 guinea. And that is how the film ends.
And the narrator says he never sees Lady Lyndon again. But at the same time, this this ending is fucking like broke my heart. This last shot. Because, like,
even though
Lord Bullingdon thinks he's doing the right thing, this last shot sort of implies that, no, this is not, like, this is still, it's bad. Like, the person who loses the most in this film is Lady Lyndon.
Yeah.
She loses her son.
Yeah.
She loses her husband. She's pretty much in debt now.
And she has to pay this awful, awful man every year.
She has to be reminded every year.
And sign her name.
But I also feel like it's sort of like a wistfulness. Like, I feel like she's still, like, pines for Barry Lyndon. I think that's sort of what that's what that last shot is.
I think it goes back to Brian's deathbed thing where they promise to stay together.
Yeah, as Brian is dying, he says, you know, which no kid would ever fucking say, but he says, promise me that you'll stay together forever. And I think that's what that is. I think that Lord Bullingdon comes in and fucks all that up, basically. I feel like eventually they would have gotten over it. Barry Lyndon would have stopped drinking a lot. His remorse would subside. He and Lady Lyndon would reconcile, and they would sort of have a good future together at this point. I feel like that would have been possible.
Yeah, I don't think Lord Bullingdon really cares, though.
No, he doesn't. Okay. Lord Bullingdon, is just as bad as Barry Lyndon, because he's only out for himself, really. Yeah. He says he's out for his mother, but I feel like
His money. He's out for his inheritance, his namesake.
No boy should be this obsessed with their mother.
And there's a great title card at the end that reads...
The epilogue?
Yeah, the epilogue is, it was in the reign of George III that the aforesaid personages lived and quarreled. Good or bad, handsome or ugly, rich or poor, they are all equal now. Yeah. I think that is absolutely wonderful. Yeah. It's so poetic. It's funny.
A.K.A. their worm food.
Yep. And I found that that was... not at the end of the book. It was not at the beginning of the book. It was just written in the middle of the first chapter somewhere. It
reminds me of...
Kubrick did his homework on this.
One of my favorite things in Gangs of New York is that last shot where Bill the Butcher's grave and Liam Neeson's character's grave, they're side by side, and you see like New York evolve through like history. And that reminded me of that, where it's just like... It doesn't matter. Everything they did... Because Gangs of New York is like this movie, and it's this big production where all this shit happens... And the last shot is like, it didn't fucking matter, really, in the end.
Did you have any other points to make? Barry Lyndon?
I didn't bring up that Brian looks a lot like Danny Torrance, which is weird. Like, they have the same haircut.
They do. Yeah. They do.
Threw me off a little. But where do you put this in your Kubrick hierarchy of films?
I don't know. I mean...
It's very good. And
I know where I put it.
This is one of the... You said that in a way like you're going to say, like, you know, right in your tailpipe. Yeah. But this is one of the, like... It's sort of a forgotten Kubrick movie.
It's the least talked about Kubrick film.
Like, when I was trying to do, like, research before the show, I was trying to look up, like, essays, and there aren't a lot about... Like, all his other movies, tons of essays about them online, in books. This movie, a lot of people don't talk about it, and it's... I think that ties into the whole inconsequential thing of it, because there's no...
It's not as accessible as his other movies. No. Like, it doesn't have, like you said, as much of a commercial value, but it also requires, like, you know, you to be able to follow along with what's happening.
I guess
Is this his only film that's not a genre movie?
Eyes Wide Shut
is not a genre movie.
I would consider this a genre. Like that period.
You could say Eyes Wide Shut is a thriller, sort of. I mean...
Like, I just consider this a straight drama.
Yeah, I don't think this really... I mean, if you want to say it's a period film, then yeah, but even that, I don't know. But I don't know. I would say this is... My number one Kubrick film for me is The Shining, as lazy as that is.
It's not lazy. Kubrick. There's nothing lazy about it.
Not lazy. It seems so obvious. Like, no shit. But like, it would be The Shining... 2001, and then probably this. Honestly, it's such a unique film. I probably won't rewatch it as much as I rewatch the other films, but if I'm ranking it from his directing, it's fucking fantastic.
Before we just had this conversation, I didn't think I would watch it a lot, but now that we've talked so much about it, like, I want to see it again, immediately to dig into it more.
Barry Lyndon is my favorite Stanley Kubrick film.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was kind of expecting you to say that with how hyped you were.
Yeah, and I didn't know that it was going to be, and I can't wait to watch it again. This is a movie I would watch over and over and over again.
Really?
The film I've watched the most by Stanley Kubrick is The Shining. Right. That would probably be my second favorite Kubrick film. I could watch this thing. It's one of those things where if it's on television, I would stop what I was doing and just watch it from the point that I turned it on to the very end.
I almost wish this was like a miniseries, so an episode would end and then I could... Because I can't picture sitting through a whole thing.
Kubrick initially thought about doing Vanity Fair, which is another Thackeray novel, right. But he said because it's so immense, it wouldn't work as a film. It would have to be a miniseries.
Right.
And in 1974 or 1973, when they started filming this... they didn't do miniseries.
Right.
That didn't happen until the late the 80s or the 90s. So I think, this might be served pretty nicely if it were a miniseries. But, this is my favorite Kubrick film. I love everything about it. I love the way it looks. I love Ryan O'Neal. It's his best performance. And I loved him in Paper Moon. I'm not a huge Ryan O'Neal fan. Yeah. Love Story is absolutely a terrible movie.
Take off that Ryan O'Neal shirt.
That's my Shaquille O'Neal shirt.
Oh, right. It was zipped Ryan up. O'Neal
One's an NBA superstar. The other ruined his daughter's life.
I would still put this behind 2001, which is my favorite, and The Shining, which is my second favorite. But I'm surprised that it's number three. Looking at the list, it's blowing me away.
It's in the top three for all of us, which is kind of amazing.
This is an incredible film, and no one talks about it. I was going to write an essay about it for this week, but... deadlines were not going to work.
Right.
So you get an F then.
Okay. Get your rubber stamp out, put it on my chest. But I still am going to write a piece on this because it's such a fascinating story. I'm not the story itself, the story about the story, the filmmaking itself is just utterly fascinating.
And it gives you a look into Kubrick's Napoleon, which was never made.
This comes from the fallout of Napoleon.
Yeah.
All that research he did about... that region of the world during that time.
Yeah,
this comes off the heels of the Napoleon film that fell apart.
I'm kind of happy that it's your number one. It's like
it's cool.
Like we did something here.
done something, folks.
It's like we gave Jeff his favorite Kubrick movie because of this podcast.
I love this movie. I love everything about it. I love the Irishness of it. Even though Ryan O'Neal's Irish accent disappears 25 minutes into it.
It comes back every now and then, but
for all Ryan O'Neal's faults, I still think he's excellent in this movie.
Yeah, he's incredible. And like Chris said, at first I didn't want him in the movie, and but he grows on you.
He does. It's brilliant casting. Kubrick knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
It shouldn't come as a surprise to me at this point, but it did.
Yeah. So Barry Lyndon.
We all hated it. Wait, I'm sorry.
You've misread this whole conversation. Is that all you wanted to say about Barry Lyndon?
There wasn't enough disco in it. That was my only. I mean, 1975.
That's Barry Gibb. You're thinking of Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees.
Enough disco. There's never enough disco, really.
Do you guys want to recommend some movies?
Sure.
Cut to print the film. Movie recommendations.
Oh, and it just ends.
Ooh.
I believe was that the Muppets?
All the air has been sucked out of the room and we're dying.
Oh.
That's pretty good, right? I can't go first.
I was not expecting any of that. That was surprising.
I'll go first, I guess.
Go for it.
All right. My pick is available on Hulu. I'll get that out right now. You can watch it as soon as you're done listening to this podcast. It's from 2005, and it's called The Puffy Chair. It's an indie comedy directed by Mark and Jay Duplass.
Duplass brothers.
Mark Duplass is in The One I Love with Elizabeth Moss.
He has a new show on HBO now, which I haven't watched yet.
What's that called?
Togetherness.
Is it any good?
I only watched like the first 10 minutes.
Starring my new crush, Melanie Lynskey, who I have a huge crush.
It seems kind of bleak, which turned me off about it.
They do a lot of bleak stuff.
Yeah.
I like Mark Duplass. He was the one good thing in Tammy.
He was in that?
Yeah, he plays Tammy's love interest.
I don't want to derail you. Okay. Go ahead.
Mark Duplass and Jay Duplass directed it. Mark Duplass stars in it. And the plot is simple. After finding a vintage Lazy Boy recliner online, just like the one that used to grace his childhood living room, Josh, played by Mark Duplass, decides to purchase the purple relic and deliver it to his father as a surprise birthday gift. Josh's simple plan is suddenly complicated when his emotionally demanding girlfriend Emily and his granola-munching brother Rhett join him on the trip that he initially planned to go on alone. During the road trip and mission, Josh learns a thing or two about himself and his relationships in the process. This is an incredibly funny movie. It's very low budget. Sometimes the camera goes out of focus, and it's clearly unintentional. But it's insanely funny. Mark Duplass is the straight man. His girlfriend is this nagging kind of baby type woman who needs a lot of attention. His brother is a fool, just an idiot who is.
That's how a lot of their movies are, where it deals with brothers, one of them being an idiot.
And his brother's just this earth child, and he's very organic, and he's like, he is out there. And it's just, it's silly. It's a silly film. There's not a lot to hate about it. And I laughed very, very, very often during it.
They have a movie called Jeff Who Lives at Home. That's what I was going to bring up. And that's it's a similar plot about two brothers, and one's like an idiot. And that movie, I thought it was going to be like, oh, this is going to be a wacky comedy. And it's just really like,
it's dark.
It's dark and like
sad.
Like, yeah, like, I was like crying at the end. I was like, I was not expecting this from this movie.
There's some darkness to this, but overall, it's really funny. And there's some sweetness to it, too.
Nice.
So, yeah. 2005's The Puffy Chair. It is on Hulu Plus.
Sometimes it is the people who no one imagines anything on who do the things that no one can imagine.
All right. Well, who wants to go next? Oscar nominee, The Imitation Game.
I'll go next because this is rather appropriate.
That's some great dialogue.
If you loved that, you should watch The Imitation Game. It's said 1,300 times.
I'm going to watch it eventually.
Good screenplay,
it's in the
folks.
Script quite a bunch.
I'm going to watch it eventually to see how much I can yell at Dave.
It's not the last line of the movie. Ugh. Yes, it is. I'm going to recommend a film that fits in the Barry Lyndon canon of timeology. Those aren't words.
Okay.
But
speaking of canons, I'm going to fire one at your gut.
Joe Wright's first film was made in 2005, ooh, called Pride and Prejudice, based on the Jane Austen novel.
Ah. Nice.
And it starred Keira Knightley in her first real breakout role.
Clearly you never saw a bend it like Beckham.
Yeah, no thanks.
How does Beckham bend it?
I don't know. Hmm. You'll have to see the film.
Hopefully at a 90-degree angle. I like things nice and orderly.
Rosamund Pike plays one of her sisters in this film.
Oh, is she in this? Now I'll have to watch it.
Both of them are nominated this year.
That's right.
Carey Mulligan's in it. This cast is fucking stacked, and it's great. But it's Pride and Prejudice, the Mr. Darcy story.
Yeah. Porn for girls, as it were.
But this version, Joe Wright's version, is so fucking good. It's beautiful, and it makes you, like, as a dude, it will make you appreciate that story. Like, it's so well done. I couldn't believe this when I saw it. It was, like, the first movie I saw that, like, made me want to learn more about this, the way Barry Lyndon did. Like, yeah. I want to know, like things about what's going on in the background and stuff.
That's cool.
And that's what Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice did for me.
This is Pride and Prejudice. Is it the sequel to Tango and Cash? Or do I have a different film?
That's a different one. Matthew McFadden's in this, and he's in a lot of Joe Wright's other movies.
I don't know. I don't even know who that is.
He plays... have you seen The Ripper Street, the BBC?
I watched the first season.
He plays the lead in that.
All right, okay.
He's a good actor. I wish he got more work. He was one of those dudes. Anyway, go watch... if you're feeling kind of dandy, go watch Pride and Prejudice.
Is it streaming anywhere, or just you gotta get the DVD?
Yeah,
you have to rent the VHS from Blockbuster.
It's usually on Netflix. Like it,
I checked, it's not on there.
Sorry, folks.
You're gonna have to buy this one.
Ugh, really?
It's one of those movies that'll be there and then it'll be gone when you go to watch it.
All right. So Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
Sometimes it is the people who no one imagines anything on who do the things that no one can imagine.
Did you guys get all that?
Sometimes.
Write that down.
That was pulled from the trailer because it has that nice music under it.
Sometimes one time is more than enough.
And I don't even get that because he's a genius. Like, everybody imagines
something. Yeah, everyone imagined the best from him because that's why they hired him. Anyway, so as I mentioned earlier in the show, Michael Mann's Black Hat came out this weekend. It sucks. So I'm going to jump back, though, for my recommendation to a Michael Mann film that doesn't suck.
Miami Vice.
Yes. It's not Miami Vice. So my pick is 1986 Manhunter.
Ooh.
So this is an adaptation of Red Dragon, of course. It's the, you know, the first book in the Hannibal Lecter series. Eventually, it got remade as Red Dragon, directed by Brett Ratner. And that film had a great cast, but holy shit, does it stink. That is a shitty movie.
It's not good.
No. But Manhunter is, it's not, a lot of people have often compared, they've been like, oh, they try and compare it to Silence of the Lambs, and it's such a different movie. This movie is a very much a product of the 80s. There's a lot of synth music. There's a lot of 80s fashion. There's a lot of, like, neon lighting, and it all works perfectly in this film. And the story, it's, you know, it's about Will Graham. It's basically, it's been adapted to the show Hannibal at this point, but it's about, you know, FBI profiler Will Graham, played by William Peterson. He's hired to you know, try and find a killer named the Tooth Fairy, played by Tom Noonan, who's a hideous actor but a talented actor.
Tom Noonan,
and he's great in this film. He's scary, as he should be. And to get, you know, info on the killer, Will Graham goes to see Hannibal Lecter, who in this film is played by Brian Cox. And a lot of people like to, you know, they compare Anthony Hopkins and Brian Cox's performance, but they're such different takes on the character. And I love Anthony Hopkins' take on it. I love it. But Brian Cox's take is such a – it's more reserved. It's more quiet. It's more disturbing. And I don't know. This is just a great sort of 80s –
Is Brian Cox better than Mads Mikkelsen?
At this point, believe it or not, as controversial as it may seem, I think Mads Mikkelsen owns that role. I think he's the best performance of that character I've ever seen.
So. I think that's fair.
He's so good on that show. But
the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock thing?
Yes.
He's like captured that character?
Pretty much. Like he's made it his own. But Brian Cox is great in this. It has a great sort of cast. Joan Allen is in this. Dennis Farina.
Oh.
Do they catch the Tooth Fairy?
I don't want to spoil it.
I've never been able to do that.
No. Well, you know, they got to leave more teeth under your pillow, Dave.
Well, I don't know where to put the bodies, though.
But yeah, this is on Netflix. I don't know. It's worth seeking out. It's got a great sort of synthy score. I don't know. I really like it. So.
I saw the Red Dragon version of the story when it came out in theaters by myself. I believe I was skipping college and went to this movie in the snow one night. And then when I got out of the movie theater, my car wouldn't start because I left my lights on. And so I had to call somebody to jump me so I didn't get in trouble for skipping school. That's my Red Dragon story. And also the fact that I could clearly see Anthony Hopkins sucking in his fat gut to play a younger Hannibal Lecter.
And Jeff's story right now is better than Red Dragon. And it's weird because this Red Dragon is literally the same plot as Manhunter, but Manhunter just does it so much better. So
what's the best adaptation of any of these Hannibal stories?
What, film or
anything? Would you say the show is still the?
I mean the show is so. I mean the show is one of my favorite shows. It's different. It's a lot.
It's
different.
Its own thing.
Yeah. So I love the show. From a film point of view, I would say Silence of the Lambs is still just
the best.
That's
a terrific film.
Jonathan Demme is a fucking fantastic director, or used to be. That's the only horror movie to ever win Best Picture, which says a lot. And that's just it's a unique sort of film. But they all have some merit. I even like the Ridley Scott Hannibal, even though
it's silly. It's a silly film.
Yeah, that movie is over the top and ridiculously gory, and that's why I kind of like it. But so, yeah. Manhunter, 1986.
Does it, folks? We're at another end.
Yes.
Chris is playing the harpsichord.
Well, I think you need to tune it because it sounds like a piano.
Thank you all for coming and wearing your powdered wigs to see me play this.
It's very itchy, this wig. I think it has lice in it.
Oh, that defeats the purpose. So what do we got coming up, folks, on cuckprintfilm.com?
We have plenty of reviews this week. What's coming out, Dave?
Project Almanac.
Oh.
Are we going to have that one?
Who knows?
We probably will.
What we probably will have is Mordecai comes out this week. Everyone's excited for Mordecai.
Me especially, since I'll be seeing it and reviewing it. I'm tickled pink about the whole thing.
There's also a movie coming out this week. It's a smaller movie. It's called The Duke of Burgundy, and it's fucking fantastic. It's 2015 has just started, but it's already going to be, I know it's going to be in my top 10 of the year, is The Duke of Burgundy. That's how good this movie is.
I watched, and we'll have my review up this week, for a Japanese film called R100,
which is unlike any film I've ever seen. Tune in to cutprintfilm.com to see if I liked it or not.
Do I have to have seen R1 through 99 to
absolutely
catch this?
Not. All right. That would be absurd of me to expect.
I wasn't in the mood to watch 99 movies before I saw this.
We also have a really, really in-depth article about Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love, written by Josh Heath, yes, who's one of our writers. It is excellent and nice. Incredibly thorough. He must have spent hours working on this.
Shout out to the Heathmeister.
That's right, Heathcliff.
Well, guys, Barry Lyndon was a good movie.
My favorite Kubrick movie, according to this guy over here. Oh, it's me. Oh, I'm looking in a mirror. I'm sorry.
So who else should you check out besides, obviously, cutprintfilm.com?
You should check out morelikeradio.com. Or should you?
No.
At this point, I would say no. You should also check out Joystick Jerks. They're a podcast. They talk about jerks. Jerk chicken, I believe.
It's yes. They love Jamaican jerk spice.
The Anti-Fanboys are back in action with all new podcasts this week.
Yeah.
So check them out.
We haven't heard it yet because they actually record it after we record ours.
Yes.
Little inside tip.
In the same room.
Yes.
Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up, guys? And you should also check out Press Square. It's another podcast that Devin from Anti-Fanboy is on.
That's right.
Also, if you want to know any movies that are coming out this week, go to projectionlist.com.
Oh, man.
Because they have a beautiful website.
This is a new site. It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Very thorough. So, yeah, that's about
just like
it.
This podcast about Barry Lyndon.
We really did a great job.
Good
I'd
work.
Like to pat you both on the back.
Hey, thanks.
With this spear.
Ow, my back.